It was so neat, so convenient. It fit in so nicely with what I knew of the facts, and still I stared at the letter, holding it gingerly by one corner as I read it again. I leaned back against the bed. What was the matter with me? I was exhausted, and I knew I'd been through too much in the last few days, but something nagged at me, and I wasn't sure it had so much to do with the letter as it did with myself, with something in my nature, some little niggling piece of self-illumination that I was fighting hard not to recognize. Either the letter was real or it was not, and there were ways to verify that. I pulled myself together wearily. I found a large envelope and slipped the letter inside, being careful not to smudge fingerprints, already thinking ahead to Con Dolan, who would love it since it confirmed all his nastiest suspicions about what had been going on back then. Was this what Sharon Napier had figured out? Was this what she could have corroborated if she'd lived long enough? I lay on the bed, fully dressed, body tense, brain wired. Who could she have hoped to blackmail with this information if she'd known? It had to be what she was up to. It had to be why she'd been killed. Someone had followed me to Las Vegas, knowing that I would see her, knowing that she might confirm what I hadn't wanted to believe. I couldn't prove it, of course, but I wondered if I was getting close enough to the truth to be in danger myself. I wanted to go home. I wanted to retreat to the safety of my small room. I wasn't thinking clearly yet, but I was getting close. For 8 years nothing had happened, and now it was all beginning again. If Nikki was innocent, then someone had been sitting pretty all this time, someone in danger of exposure now. I saw for an instant the look that had flashed in Nikki's eyes, unreasoning malevolence, a harsh, irrational rage. She had set this all in motion. I had to consider the possibility that Sharon Napier was blackmailing her, that Sharon knew something that could link Nikki to Libby's death. If Sharon had dropped out of sight, it was possible that Nikki had hired me to flush her out, and that Nikki had then eliminated any threat with one quick shot. She might also have followed me back to Sherman Oaks for a frantic search through Libby's belongings, for anything that might have linked Libby to Lawrence Fife. There were pieces missing yet, but they would fall into place, and then maybe the whole of it would make sense, assuming I lived long enough myself to figure it out. Chapter 18. I dragged myself out of bed at 6 o'clock a.m. I hadn't slept at all. My mouth felt stale, and I brushed my teeth. I showered and dressed. I longed to run, but I felt too vulnerable to jog down the middle of San Vicente at that hour. I packed, closing up my typewriter, shoving the pages of my report into my briefcase. I loaded the boxes into my car again, along with my suitcase. The lights in the office were on, and I could see Arlette taking jelly donuts out of a bakery box, putting them on a plastic plate with a clear dome lid. Water was already heating for that awful, flat, instant coffee. She was licking powdered sugar from her fingers when I went in. "God, you're up awful early," she said. "You want breakfast?" I shook my head. Even with my penchant for junk food, I wouldn't eat a jelly donut. "No, but thanks," I said. "I'm checking out." "Right now?" I nodded, almost too tired to talk. She finally seemed to sense that this was the wrong time to chat. She got my bill ready, and I signed it, not even bothering to add up the charges. She usually made a mistake, but I didn't care. I got in my car and headed for Sherman Oaks. There was a light on in Grace's kitchen, which I approached from around the side of the building. I tapped on the window, and after a moment she came into the service porch and opened the side door. She looked small and precise this morning, in an A-line corduroy skirt and a coffee-colored cotton turtleneck. She kept her voice low.
"Raymond's not awake yet, but there's coffee if you like," she said.
"Thanks, but I've got a breakfast meeting at 8, I said, lying without much thought. Whatever I said would be passed on to Lyle, and my whereabouts were none of his business, or hers. I just wanted to drop the boxes off.
"Did you find anything?" she asked.
Her gaze met mine briefly, and then she blinked, glancing first at the floor and then off to my left. "Too late," I said, trying to ignore the flush of relief that tinted her cheeks.
"That's unfortunate," she murmured, placing a hand against her throat. "I'm sure it wasn't Lyle."
"It doesn't matter much anyway," I said. I felt sorry for her in spite of myself.
I packed everything back as neatly as I could. I'll just stack the boxes in the basement near the bin. You'll probably want to have that repaired when you get the basement door fixed.
She nodded. She moved to close the door, and I stepped back, watching her pad back into the kitchen in her soft-soled slippers. I felt as if I'd personally violated her life somehow, that everything was ending on a bad note. She'd been as helpful as she knew how, and she'd gotten little in return. I had to shrug. There was nothing I could do at this point. I unloaded the car, making several trips, stacking boxes just inside the damaged bin. Unconsciously, I listened for Lyle. The light in the basement was cold and gray by day, but aside from the splintered lathe work and the shattered window, there was no other evidence of the intruder. I went out the back way on the last trip up from the basement, checking idly for smashed cigarette butts, bloody fingerprints, a small printed business card perhaps dropped by whoever broke in. I came up the concrete stairs outside, looking off to the right at the path the intruder had taken. Across the patchy grass in the backyard, over a sagging wire fence, and through a tangle of bushes. I could see through to the next street where the car must have been parked. It was early morning yet, and the sunlight was flat and still. I could hear heavy traffic on the Ventura Freeway, which was visible in glimpses through the clumps of trees off to the right. The ground wasn't even soft enough to absorb footprints. I moved around the building to the driveway on my left, noting with interest that the power mower had been pulled off to one side. My palms were still ripped up in places, 2-inch tracks where I'd skidded across the gravel on my hands. I hadn't even thought to use Bactine, and I hoped I wouldn't be subject to raging gangrene, perilous infections, or blood poisoning. Dangers my aunt had warned me about every time I skinned my knee. I got back in my car and headed for Santa Teresa, stopping in Thousand Oaks for breakfast. I was home by 10 o'clock in the morning. I wrapped myself up in a quilt on the couch and slept for most of the day. At 4 o'clock, I drove out to Nikki's beach house. I had called to say I was back in town, and she invited me out for a drink. I wasn't sure yet how much I would tell her, or how much, if anything, I would hold back. But after my recent gnawing suspicions about her, I wanted to test my perceptions. There are moments in every investigation when my speculations about what's possible cloud and confuse any lingering sense I have of what's actually true. I wanted to check out my intuitions. The house was situated on a bluff overlooking the ocean. The lot was small, irregular in shape, surrounded by eucalyptus trees. The house was tucked into the landscaping, laurel and yew, with pink and red geraniums planted along the path. Its exterior made of cedar shingles, still a raw-looking wood-brown, the roof line undulating like an ocean swell. There was a large oval window in the front, flanked by 2 bow windows, all undraped. The lawn was a pale green, tender blades of grass looking almost edible, curls of eucalyptus bark intermingled like wood shavings. White and yellow daisies grew in careless patches. The whole effect was of subtle neglect, a refined wilderness, untended but subdued, curiously appealing with a thick scent of ocean overlaid and the dull thunder of waves crashing down below. The air was moist and smelled of salt, wind buffeting the ragged grass. Where the house in Montebello was boxy, substantial, conventional, plain, this was a whimsical cottage, all wide angles, windows, and unpainted wood. The front door had a tall, oval, leaded glass window in it, filled with tulip shapes, and the doorbell sounded like wind chimes. Nikki appeared at once. She was wearing a celery green caftan, its bodice embroidered with mirrors the size of dimes, the sleeves wide. Her hair was pulled up and away from her face, tied with a pale green velvet ribbon. She seemed relaxed, her wide forehead unlined, the gray eyes looking light and clear, her mouth faintly tinted with pink, curving upward as though from some secret merriment. The languidness in her manner was gone, and she was animated, energetic. I had brought the photograph album Diane had given me, and I handed it to her as she closed the door behind me. "What's this?" she asked. "Diane put it together for Colin," I said. "Come see him," she said. "We're making bread." I followed her through the house. There were no square rooms at all. The spaces flowed into one another, connected by gleaming pale wood floors and bright shag rugs. There were windows everywhere, plants, skylights. A free-form fireplace in the living room looked as if it had been constructed from buff-colored boulders, piled up randomly like the entrance to a cave.
On the far wall, a crude ladder led up to a loft that overlooked the ocean. Nikki smiled back at me happily, placing the album on the glass coffee table as she passed. The kitchen was a semicircle, wood and white formica, and luscious, healthy houseplants, windows on three sides, looking onto a deck with the ocean stretching out beyond, wide and gray in the late afternoon. Colin was kneading bread, his back to me, his concentration complete. His hair was the same pale, no-color shade as Nikki's, silky like hers where it curled down on his neck. His arms looked wiry and strong, his hands capable, fingers long. He gathered the edges of the dough, pressing inward, turning it over again. He looked like he was just on the verge of adolescence, beginning to shoot up in height, but not awkward yet. Nikki touched him, and he turned quickly, his gaze sliding over to me at once. I was startled. His eyes were large, tilted slightly, an army fatigue green. His lashes thick and dark. His face was narrow, chin pointed, ears coming to a delicate point, a pixie effect with the fine hair forming a point on his forehead. The two of them looked like an illustration from a fairy book, fragile and beautiful and strange. His eyes were peaceful, empty, glowing with acute intelligence. I have seen the same look in cats, their eyes wise, aloof, grave. When I spoke to Nikki, he watched our lips, his own lips parting breathlessly so that the effect was oddly sexual. "I think I just fell in love," I said, and laughed. Nikki smiled, signing to Colin, her fingers graceful, succinct. Colin flashed a smile at me, much older than his years. I felt myself flush. "I hope you didn't tell him that," I said. "We'd probably have to run off together."
"I told him you were my first friend after prison. I told him you needed a drink," she said, still signing, eyes resting on Colin's face. "Most of the time we don't sign this much. I'm just brushing up."
While Nikki opened a bottle of wine, I watched Colin work the bread dough. He offered to let me help, and I shook my head, preferring to watch his agile hands, the dough developing a smooth skin almost magically as he worked. He made gruff, unintelligible sounds now and then, without seeming aware of it. Nikki gave me chilled white wine in a glass with a thin stem while she drank Perrier.
"Here's to parole," she said.
"You look much more relaxed," I said.
"Oh, I am. I feel great. It's so good to have him here. I follow him everywhere. I feel like a puppy dog. He gets no peace."
Her hands were moving automatically, and I could see that she was translating for him simultaneously with her comments to me. It made me feel rude and clumsy that I couldn't sign, too. I felt as if there were things I wanted to say to him myself, questions I wanted to ask about the silence in his head. It was like charades of some kind, Nikki using body, arms, face, her whole self totally involved, Colin signing back to her casually. He seemed to speak much more quickly than she, without deliberation. Sometimes Nikki would halt, struggling for a word, remembering, laughing at herself as she relayed to him her own forgetfulness. His smile in those moments was indulgent, full of affection, and I envied them this special world of secrets, of self-mockery, wherein Colin was the master and Nikki the apprentice. I couldn't imagine Nikki with any other kind of child. Colin placed the smooth dough in the bowl, turning it once to coat its pale surface with butter, covering it carefully then with a clean white towel. Nikki motioned him into the living room where she showed him the photo album. Colin settled on the edge of the couch, leaning forward, elbows on his knees, the album open on the coffee table in front of him. His face was still, but his eyes took in everything, and he was already engrossed in the snapshots. Nikki and I went out onto the deck. It was getting late, but there was still enough sunlight to create the illusion of warmth. She stood at the railing, staring out at the ocean that rumbled below us. I could see tangles of kelp just under the surface in places, dark strands undulating in waves of paler green.
"Nikki, did you talk to anyone about where I was and what I was up to?" I asked.
"Not at all," she said, startled.
"What makes you ask?"
I filled her in on the events of the last few days. Sharon Napier's death, my talks with Greg and Diane, the letter I'd found among Libby Glass's effects. My trust in her was instinctive.
"Would you recognize his handwriting?"
"Sure." I took the manila envelope out of my purse, carefully removing the letter, which I unfolded for her. She glanced at it briefly.
"That's him," she said.
"I'd like you to read it," I said. "I want to see if it coincides with your intuitions about what was going on." Reluctantly, her gaze dropped back to the pale blue pages.
When she finished, she seemed almost embarrassed. I wouldn't have guessed it was that serious. His other affairs weren't.
What about Charlotte Mercer?
She's a bitch. She's an alcoholic. She called me once. I hated her, and she hated him. You should have heard what she said.
I folded the letter carefully.
I don't get it. From Charlotte Mercer to Libby Glass, that's quite a leap.
I assumed he was a man of taste.
Nicky shrugged. He was easily seduced. It was his own vanity. Charlotte is beautiful, in her own way.
Was she in the process of divorcing? Is that how they met?
Nicky shook her head. We socialized with them. Judge Mercer was a sort of mentor of Lawrence's at one point. I don't imagine he ever found out about the affair. It would have killed him, I think. He's the only decent judge we've got, anyway. You know what the rest are like.
I only talked to her a short time, I said. But I can't see how she could be involved. It had to be somebody who knew where I was, and how could she have come by that information? Somebody had to have followed me up to Las Vegas. Sharon's murder was too closely timed to have been coincidence.
Colin appeared at Nicky's side, placing the open photograph album up on the railing. He pointed to one of the snapshots, saying something I couldn't understand at all, an indistinct blur of vowels. It was the first time I'd heard him speak. His voice was deeper than I would have imagined for a 12-year-old.
"That's Diane's junior high school graduation," Nicky said to him.
Colin looked at her for a moment, and then pointed again more emphatically. He put his index finger in front of his mouth and moved it up and down rapidly. Nicky frowned.
"Who what, honey?"
Colin placed his finger on the picture of a group of people.
"That's Diane and Greg and Diane's friend Terry and Diane's mother," she said to him, enunciating carefully and signing at the same time.
A puzzled smile formed on Colin's face. Colin spread his hands out, putting his thumb against his forehead and then his chin. Nicky laughed this time, her expression as puzzled as his.
"No, that's Nana," she said, pointing to a snapshot one page back. "This is Diane's mother, not Daddy's. The mother of Greg and Diane. Don't you remember Nana?"
"Oh, God, how could he?" she flashed at me. "She died when he was a year old." She looked back at him. Colin made some guttural sounds, something negative and frustrated. I wondered what would happen to his temper when puberty really caught up with him. Again the thumb against the forehead, then the chin. Nicky shot me another look.
"He keeps saying Daddy's mother for Gwen. How do you explain ex-wife?"
She signed again patiently. Colin shook his head slightly, suddenly unsure of himself. He watched her for a moment more, as though some other explanation might be forthcoming. He took the album and backed away, eyes still fixed on Nicky's face. He signed once more, flushing uncomfortably. Apparently he didn't want to look foolish in front of me.
"We'll go through those together in a minute," she signed to him, translating for me.
Colin moved slowly back through the sliding glass doors, pushing the screen door shut.
"Sorry for the interruption," she said briefly.
"That's all right. I've got to go anyway," I said.
"You can stay for supper if you like. I've made a big pot of beef bourguignon. It's great with Colin's bread."
"Thanks, but I've got all kinds of things to do," I said.
Nicky walked me to the door, signing our final chit-chat without even being aware of it. I got in my car and sat for a moment, puzzled by Colin's puzzlement over Gwen. That was odd. Very odd. Chapter 19. When I got back to my apartment, Charlie Scorsone was sitting on my doorstep. I felt grubby and unprepared, and I realized with embarrassment that I'd been entertaining a fantasy of how we'd meet again, and it wasn't like this.
"God, don't get all excited, Milhone," he said when he saw the expression on my face.
I got out my key.
"I'm sorry," I said, "but you catch me at the worst possible times."
"You have a date," he said.
"No, I don't have a date. I look like shit."
I unlocked the door and flipped on the desk lamp, letting him follow me in.
"At least I caught you in a good mood," he said, making himself at home.
He sauntered out to the kitchen and got out the last beer. The familiarity in his manner made me cross.
"Look, I've got laundry to do. I haven't been to the grocery store for a week. My mail is piled up. The whole place is covered with dust. I haven't even shaved my legs since I saw you last."
"You need a haircut, too," he said.
"No, I don't. It always looks like this."
He smiled, shaking his head.
"Get dressed. We'll go out."
I don't want to go out. I want to get my life in shape.
You can do that tomorrow. It's Sunday. I bet you always do shit like that on Sunday anyway.
I stared at him.
It was true.
Wait a minute. Here's how it's supposed to go, I said patiently. I get home, I do all my chores, get a good night's sleep, which I could sorely use, then tomorrow I call you and we see each other tomorrow night.
I gotta be at the office tomorrow night. I have a client coming in.
On Sunday night?
We've got a court appearance first thing Monday morning, and this is the only thing we could work out. I just got back into town myself Thursday night, and I'm up to my ass. I stared at him some more, wavering. Where would we go? Would I have to dress up? Well, I'm not going to take you anywhere looking like that, he said. I glanced down. I was still wearing jeans and the shirt I'd slept in, but I wasn't ready to back down yet. What's wrong with this? I asked perversely. Take a shower and change clothes. I'll pick up some stuff at the grocery store if you give me a list. By the time I get that done, you'll be ready, yes? I like to shop for my own stuff. Anyway, all I need is milk and beer. Then I'll take you to a supermarket after we eat, he said, emphasizing every single word. We drove down to the ranch house in Ojai, one of those elegant restaurants where the waiter stands at your table and recites the menu like a narrative poem. Shall I order for us, or would that offend your feminine sensibilities? Go ahead, I said, feeling oddly relieved. I'd like that. While he and the waiter conferred, I studied Charlie's face surreptitiously. It was strong and square, good jawline, visible dent in his chin, full mouth. His nose looked like it might have been broken once, but mended skillfully, leaving only the slightest trace just below the bridge. His glasses had large lenses, tinted a blue-gray, and behind them his blue eyes were as clear as sky. Sandy lashes, sandy brows, his thick sandy hair only beginning to recede. He had big hands, big bones in his wrists, and I could see a feathering of sandy hair at the cuff. There was something else about him, too, smoldering and opaque, the same sense I'd had before of sexuality that surfaced now and then. Sometimes he seemed to emit an almost audible hum, like a line of power stations marching inexorably across a hillside, ominous and marked with danger signs. I was afraid of him. The waiter was nodding and moving away. Charlie turned back to me, obscurely amused. I felt myself go mute, but he pretended not to notice, and I felt dimly grateful, faintly flushed. I was overcome with the same self-consciousness I'd felt once at a birthday party in the sixth grade, when I realized that all the other little girls had worn nylon stockings and I was still wearing stupid white ankle socks. The waiter returned with a bottle of wine, and Charlie went through the usual ritual. When our glasses were filled, he touched his rim to mine, his eyes on my face. I sipped, startled by the delicacy of the wine, which was pale and cool. "So, how's the investigation going?" he asked when the waiter had left. I shook my head, taking a moment to orient myself. "I don't want to talk about it," I said shortly, and then caught myself. "I don't mean to be rude," I said in a softened tone. "I just don't think talking about it will help. It's not going well." "I'm sorry to hear that," he said. "It's bound to improve."
I shrugged and watched while he lit a cigarette and snapped the lighter shut. "I didn't know you smoked," I said.
"Now and then," he said.
He offered me the pack, and I shook my head again. He seemed relaxed, in possession of himself, a man of sophistication and grace. I felt doltish and tongue-tied, but he didn't seem to expect anything of me, talking on about inconsequential things. He seemed to operate at half speed, taking his own time about everything. It made me aware of the usual tension with which I live, that keyed-up state of raw nerve that makes me grind my teeth in my sleep. Sometimes I get so wired that I forget to eat at all, only remembering at night, even then not being hungry, but wolfing down food anyway as though the speed and quantity of consumption might atone for the infrequency. With Charlie I could feel my time clock readjust, my pace slowing to match his. When I finished the second glass of wine, I heaved a sigh, and only then did I realize that I'd been holding myself tensely, like a joke snake ready to jump out of a box.
"Feel better?" he said.
"Yes."
"Good. Then we'll eat."
The meal that followed was one of the most sensual I ever experienced. Fresh, tender bread with a crust of flaky layers, spread with a buttery pâté, Boston lettuce with a delicate vinaigrette, sand dabs sautéed in butter and served with succulent green grapes. There were fresh raspberries for dessert with a dollop of tart cream, and all the time Charlie's face across the table from me, shadowed by that suggestion of caution, that hint of something stark and fearful held back, pulling me forward even while I felt myself kept in check.
"How'd you end up in law school?" I asked him when coffee arrived.
"Accident, I guess. My father was a drunk and a bum. A real shit. Knocked me around a lot. Not seriously. More like a piece of furniture that got in his way. He beat my mother, too."
"Doesn't do much for your self-esteem," I ventured.
Charlie shrugged.
"It was good for me, actually. Made me tough. Let me know I couldn't depend on anyone but myself, which is a lesson you might as well learn when you're 10. I took care of me."
"You worked your way through school?"
"Every nickel's worth. I picked up money ghosting papers for jocks, sitting in on tests, writing C-minus answers so no one would suspect. You'd be surprised how tricky it is to miss just enough questions to look genuine. I had regular jobs, too, but after I watched half a fraternity get into law school on my smarts, I figured I might as well try it myself."
"What did your father do when he didn't drink?"
"Construction, till his health broke down. He finally died of cancer. Took him 6 years. Bad stuff. I didn't give a shit, and he knew it. All that pain?"
"Served him right," he said, and shook his head.
"My mother died 4 months after he did. I thought she'd be relieved he was gone. Turns out she was dependent on the abuse."
"Why do estate law? That doesn't seem like you. I picture you doing criminal law, something like that."
"Listen, my father pissed away everything he had. I ended up with nothing, less than nothing. It took me years to pay off his hospital bills and his fucking debts. I had to pay for my mother's death, too, which at least was quick, God bless her, but hardly cheap. So now I show people how to outwit the government, even in death. A lot of my clients are dead, so we get along very well, and I make sure their greedy heirs get more than they deserve. Also, when you're executor for somebody's estate, you get paid on time, and nobody calls you up about your bill."
"Not a bad deal," I said.
"Not at all," he agreed.
"Have you ever been married?"
"Nope. I never had time for that. I work. That's the only thing that interests me. I don't like the idea of giving someone else the right to make demands."
"In exchange for what?"
I had to laugh. I felt the same way myself. His tone throughout was ironic, and the look he laid on me then was oddly sexual, full of a strange, compelling male heat, as though money and power and sexuality were all somehow tangled up for him and fed on one another. There was really nothing open or loose or free about him, however candid he might seem, but I knew that it was precisely his opacity that appealed to me. Did he know that I was attracted to him? He gave little indication of his own feelings one way or the other. When we finished our coffee, he signaled for the waiter without a word and paid the check. Conversation between us was dwindling anyway, and I let it lie, feeling watchful, quiet, even wary of him again. We moved through the restaurant, our bodies close, but our behavior polite, circumspect. He opened the door for me. I passed through. He'd made no gesture toward me, verbally or otherwise, and I was suddenly disconcerted lest my sense of his pull turn out to be something generated in me and not reciprocal. Charlie took my arm briefly, guiding me up a shallow step, but as soon as we were on smooth pavement again, he dropped his hand. He went around to my side of the car, he opened the door, and I got in. I didn't think I'd said anything flirtatious, and I was glad of that, curious still about his intentions toward me. He was so matter-of-fact, so removed. We drove back to Santa Teresa, saying little. I was feeling mute again, not uncomfortable, but languid. As we approached the outskirts of town, he reached over and took my hand noncommittally. It felt like a low-voltage current was suffusing my left side. He kept his left hand on the steering wheel. With his right hand, he was carelessly, casually rubbing my fingers, his attitude inattentive. I was trying to be as casual as he, trying to pretend there might be some other way to interpret these smoldering sexual signals that made the air crackle between us and caused my mouth to go dry. What if I was wrong, I thought? What if I fell on the man like a dog on a bone, only to discover that his meaning was merely friendly, absent-minded, or impersonal? I couldn't think about anything because there was no sound between us, nothing said, Not anything I could react to or fix on, no way to divert myself. He was making it hard to breathe. I felt like a glass rod being rubbed on silk. Out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw his face turn toward me. I glanced at him.
"Hey," he said softly. "Guess what we're going to do."
Charlie shifted in his seat slightly and pressed my hand between his legs. A charge shot through me and I groaned involuntarily. Charlie laughed, a low excited sound, and then he looked back at the road. Making love with Charlie was like being taken into a big warm machine. Nothing was required of me. Everything was attended to with such ease, such fluidity. There were no awkward moments. There was no holding back, no self-consciousness, no hesitation, no heed. It was as though a channel had been opened between us, sexual energy flowing back and forth without impediment. We made love more than once. At first there was too much hunger, too much heat. We came at each other with a clash, an intensity that admitted of no tenderness. We crashed against one another like waves on a breakwater, surges of pleasure driving straight up, curling back again. All of the emotional images were of pounding assault, sensations of boom and buffet and battering ram until he had broken through to me, rolling down again and over me until all my walls were reduced to rubble and ash. He raised himself up on his elbow then and kissed me long and sweet, and it began all over again. Only this time at his pace, half speed, agonizingly slow like the gradual ripening of a peach on a limb. I could feel myself go all rosy, turn to honey and oil, a mellowing ease filtering through me like a sedative. We lay there afterward, laughing and sweaty and out of breath, and then he encompassed me in sleep, the weight of his big arms pinning me to the bed. But far from feeling trapped, I felt comforted and safe, as though nothing could ever harm me as long as I stayed in the shadow of this man, this sheltering cave of heat and flesh, where I was tucked away until morning without waking once. At 7 o'clock I felt him kiss me lightly on the forehead, and after that the door closed softly. By the time I'd stirred myself awake, he was gone. Chapter 20. I got up at 9 o'clock and spent Sunday taking care of personal chores. I cleaned my place, did laundry, went to the supermarket, and had a nice visit in the afternoon with my landlord, who was sunning himself in the backyard. For a man of 81, Henry Pitts has an amazing set of legs. He also has a wonderful beaky nose, a thin aristocratic face, shocking white hair, and eyes that are periwinkle blue. The overall effect is very sexy, electric, and the photographs I've seen of him in his youth don't even half compare. At 20 and 30 and 40, Henry's face seems too full, too unformed. As the decades pass, the pictures begin to reveal a man growing lean and fierce, until now he seems totally concentrated, like a basic stock boiled down to a rich elixir. "Listen, Henry," I said, plunking down on the grass near his chaise. "You live entirely too idle a life." "Sin and degradation," he said complacently, not even bothering to open his eyes. "You had company last night." "A sleepover date, just like our mamas warned us about."
"How was it?"
"I'm not telling," I said. "What kind of crossword puzzle did you concoct this week?"
"An easy one. All doubles. Prefixes, di, bi, bis, dis, twin, twain, binary, things like that. Try this one, 6 letters, double impression."
"Already I give up. Mackle. It's a printer's term, kind of a cheat, but the fit was so nice. Try this, double meaning, 9 letters.
"Henry, would you quit that?"
"Ambiguity. I'll leave it on your doorstep."
"No, don't. I get those things in my head and I can't get them out."
He smiled.
"You run yet?"
"No, but I'm on my way," I said, hopping up again. I crossed the grass, glancing back at him with a grin. He was putting suntan oil on his knees, which were already a gorgeous shade of caramel. I wondered how much it really mattered that there was a 50-year difference in our ages. But then again, I had Charlie Scorsone to think about. I changed clothes and did my run.
and thought about him.
Monday morning I went in to see Con Dolan at Homicide. He was talking on the phone when I got there, so I sat down at his desk. He was tipped back in his chair, feet jammed against the edge of the desk, the receiver laid loosely against his ear. He was saying, looking bored. He scanned me with care, taking in every detail of my face, as though he were memorizing me all over again, running me through a computer file of known felons, looking for a match. I stared back at him. In moments I could see the young man in his face, which was sagging now and worn, pouches beneath his eyes, hair slicked down, cheeks turning soft at the jawline as though the flesh were beginning to warm and melt. The skin on his neck had collapsed into a series of fine folds, reddened and bulging slightly over his starched shirt collar. I feel an ornery kind of kinship with him, which I never can quite identify. He's tough, emotionless, withdrawn, calculating, harsh. I've heard he's mean, too, but what I see in him is the overriding competence. He knows his business, and he takes no guff, and despite the fact he gives me a hard time whenever he can, I know he likes me, though grudgingly. I saw his attention sharpen. He focused on what was being said to him, and it made his temper climb.
All right, now, you listen here, Mitch, because I've said all I intend to say. We're getting down to the short strokes on this, and I don't want you fucking up my case. Yeah, I know that. Yeah, that's what you said. I just want it clear between us. I gave your boy all the breaks I mean to give, so either he cooperates or we can put him right back where he was. Yeah, will you talk to him again?
Con dropped the phone down from a height, not exactly slamming it, but making his point. He was done. He looked at me through a haze of irritation. I put the manila envelope on his desk. He put his feet on the floor.
"What is this?" he said snappishly.
He peered in through the flap, removing the letter I'd found in Libby Glass's effects. Even without knowing what it was, he held it by the edges, his eyes raking the contents once and then going back again with caution. He glanced up at me sharply. He tucked it back in the envelope.
"Where'd you get it?"
Libby Glass's mother kept all her stuff. It was shoved in a paperback book. I picked it up Friday. Can you have it checked for fingerprints?"
The look he gave me was cold. "Why don't we talk about Sharon Napier first?"
I felt a spurt of fear, but I didn't hesitate. "She's dead," I said, reaching for the envelope. He smacked his fist down on it, and I drew my hand back. We locked eyes. "A friend of mine in Vegas told me," I said. "That's how I knew."
"Horseshit. You drove up there." "Wrong. God damn it, don't lie to me," he snapped.
I could feel my temper flare. "You want to read me my rights, Lieutenant Dolan? You want to hand me a certification of notification of my constitutional rights? Because I'll read it and sign it if you like, and then I'll call my attorney, and when he gets down here we can chat. How's that?"
"You've been on this business 2 weeks and somebody shows up dead. You cross me up and I'll have your ass. Now you give it to me straight. I told you to keep out of this."
"Uh-huh. You told me to keep out of trouble, which I did. You said you'd like a little help making the connection between Libby Glass and Lawrence Fife, and I gave you that," I said, indicating the manila envelope. He picked it up and tossed it in the trash. I knew it was just for effect. I tried another tack.
"Come on, Con," I said. "I had nothing to do with Sharon Napier's death. Not in any way, shape, or form. What do you think, that I'd run up there and kill somebody who might be of help? You're crazy. I never even went to Vegas. I was down at the Salton Sea talking to Greg Fife, and if you doubt my word, call him."
I shut my mouth then and stared at him hotly, letting this bold admixture of truth and utter falsehood penetrate his darkened face.
"How'd you know where she was?"
"Because I spent a day and a half on a trace through a Nevada PI named Bob Dietz. I was going to drive to Vegas after I talked to Greg. I put a call through first and found out somebody'd put a bullet in her. How do you think I feel about that? She might have filled in a few blanks for me. I've got it tough enough as it is. This goddamn case is 8 years old. Now give me a break."
"Who knew you intended to talk to her?"
"I don't know that. If you're implying that somebody killed her to keep her from talking to me, I think you're wrong, but I couldn't swear to that.
She was stepping on a lot of toes up there, from what I hear. And don't ask me the particulars, because I don't know. I just hear she was treading on somebody's turf.
He sat and stared at me then, and I guessed that I must have hit a vein. The rumors my friend in Vegas had passed on must have lined up with whatever the Las Vegas Police Department had turned up. I was personally convinced that she'd been killed to shut her mouth, that someone had followed me and had gotten to her just in time. But I was damned if I was going to have a finger pointed at me. I couldn't see what purpose it would serve, and it would only prevent me from getting on with my own inquiries. I still wasn't entirely easy about the fact that someone else had probably tipped off the Las Vegas PD about the shooting. One more minute in her apartment, and I'd have been in a real jam, which might have closed down my investigation for good. Whatever regret I felt for my involvement with her death wasn't going to be expiated by my being caught up in the aftermath.
"What else have you found out about Libby Glass?" he asked me then, his tone shifting slightly along with the subject.
"Not a lot. Right now I'm still trying to make a few pieces fall into place, and so far I'm not having much luck. If that letter really was written by Lawrence Fife, then at least we can nail that down. Frankly, I hope it wasn't, but Nicky seems to think the writing is his. There's something about it that doesn't sit well with me. Can you let me know if the prints match?"
Khan pushed impatiently at a stack of files on his desk.
"I'll think about that," he said. "I don't want us to get buddy-buddy over this."
"Believe me, we will never be close friends," I said. And for some reason his expression softened slightly, and I almost thought he might smile.
"Get out of here," he said gruffly.
I went. I got in my car and left the downtown area, taking a left on Anaconda down to the beach. It was a gorgeous day, sunny and cool, with fat clouds squatting on the horizon. There were sailboats here and there, probably planted by the Chamber of Commerce to look picturesque for the tourists who straggled along the sidewalk, taking snapshots of other tourists who were sitting in the grass. At Ludlow Beach, I followed the hill upward, and then branched off onto the steep side street where Marcia Threadgill lived. I parked and got out my binoculars, scanning her patio. All of her plants were present and accounted for, and they were all looking healthier than I liked. There was no sign of Marcia or the neighbor she feuded with. I wished she would move so I could take pictures of her lugging 50-pound cartons of books down to a U-Haul van. I'd even settle for a glimpse of her coming back from the grocery store with a big double bag of canned goods ripping across the bottom from the weight. I focused in on her patio again and noticed for the first time that there were actually four plant hooks screwed into the wooden overhang of the patio above. On the hook at the near corner was the mammoth plant I'd seen before, but the other three hooks were empty. I put the binoculars away and went into the building, pausing at the landing between the second and third floors. I peered down through the stair railing. If I situated myself correctly, I'd be able to focus my camera at just the right angle to pick up a nice view of Marcia's front door. Having ascertained that much, I went out to my car again and drove to the Gateway supermarket. I hefted a few houseplants potted in plastic and found one that was just right for my purposes. 25 pounds of sturdy trunk with a series of vicious sword-like leaves protruding at intervals. I picked up some pre-tied gift ribbons in a fire engine red and a get-well card with a sentimental verse. All of this was taking up precious time that I would have preferred devoting to Nicky Fife's business, but I have my rent to account for, and I felt like I owed California fidelity for at least half a month. I went back to Marsh's apartment and parked in front. I checked my camera, tore open the packaged ribbons, and stuck several of them to the plastic pot in a jaunty fashion, and then tucked the card down inside with a signature scrawled on it that even I couldn't read. I hoisted plant, camera, and myself with a slightly thudding heart up the steep concrete stairs into the building and up to the second floor. I set the plant down near Marsh's doorsill and then went up to the landing where I checked my light meter, set up the camera, and adjusted the focus on the lens. Nice angle, I thought. This was going to be a work of art. I trotted back down, took a deep breath, and rang Ms. Threadgill's bell, racing back up the stairs again at breakneck speed. I picked up the camera and checked the focus again. My timing was perfect. Marcia Threadgill opened her front door and stared down with surprise and puzzlement.
She was wearing shorts and a crocheted halter, and in the background the voice of Olivia Newton-John boomed out like an audible lollipop. I hesitated a moment and then peered over the rail. Marcia was leaning over to extract the card. She read it, turned it over, and then studied its face again, shrugging with bewilderment. She glanced down the hallway to her left, and then moved forward and peered down the stairwell, as though she might catch sight of the delivery person. I began to click off pictures, the whir of the 35mm camera obscured by the record being played too loudly. Marcia padded back to her doorsill and bent casually from the waist, picking up 25 pounds of plant without even bothering to bend her knees, as we've all been instructed to in the exercise manuals. As soon as she'd trucked the plant inside, I raced back down the stairs and out to the street, focusing again from the sidewalk below just as she appeared on the patio and placed the plant up on the rail. She disappeared. I backed up several yards, attaching the telephoto lens, waiting then with my breath held. Back she came with what must have been a kitchen chair. I clicked off some nice shots of her climbing up. Sure enough, she picked up the plant by the wire, heaving it to shoulder height, muscles straining until she caught the wire loop on the overhead hook. The effort was such that her halter hiked up, and I got a nice shot of Marcia Threadgill's quite large bosom peeping out. I turned away just in time, I suspect, catching only the inkling of her quick look around to see if anyone else had spotted her exposure. When I glanced back casually, she was gone. I dropped the film off to be developed, making sure it was properly dated and identified. Still, photographs were not going to be much good to us, especially without a witness to corroborate my testimony as to the date, time, and circumstance. But the pictures might at least persuade the claims manager at California Fidelity to pursue the case, which was the best I could hope for at this point. With his authorization, I could go back with a video outfit and a real photographer and pick up some footage that would stand up in court. I should have known he wouldn't see it that way. Andy Motika is in his early 40s, and he still bites his nails. He was working on his right hand that day, trying to gnaw off what remained of his thumb. It made me nervous just to look at him. I kept expecting him to rip loose a big triangle of flesh at the corner of his cuticle. I could feel my face set with distaste, and I had to stare just over his shoulder to the left. Before I was even halfway through my explanation, he was shaking his head. "Can't do it," he said bluntly. "This chick doesn't even have an attorney. We're supposed to get a signed release from the doctor next week. No deal. I don't want to mess this one up. $4,800 is chicken feed. It'd cost us $10,000 to go into court. You know that." "Well, I know, but nothing. The risk is too great. I don't even know why Mac had you check this one out. Look, I know it frosts your ass, but so what? You set her off and she'll go straight out and hire a lawyer, and next thing you know she'll sue us for $1,000,000. Forget it."
"She'll just do it again somewhere else," I said. Andy shrugged. "Why do I waste my time on this shit?" I said, voice rising with frustration.
"Beats me," he said conversationally. "Let me see the pics, though, when you get 'em back. Her tits are huge."
"Screw you," I said, and moved on into my office.
Chapter 21. There were two messages on my answering service. The first was from Gary Steinberg. I called him back.
"Hey, Kinsey," he said when I'd been put through.
"Hi, Gary, how are you?"
"Not bad. I've got a little piece of information for you," he said.
I could tell from his tone that he was feeling satisfied with himself, but what he said next still took me by surprise.
"I looked up that job application on Lyle Abernathy this morning. Apparently he worked for a while as an apprentice to a locksmith. Some old guy named Fears."
"A locksmith?"
"That's right. I called the guy this morning. You'd have loved it. I said Abernathy had applied for a job as a security guard, and I was doing a background check. Fears hemmed and hawed some and finally said he'd had to fire the kid. Fears was getting a lot of complaints about missing cash on jobs where Lyle had worked, and he began to suspect he was involved in petty thievery. He never could prove it, but he couldn't afford to take the chance. So he let Lyle go."
"Oh, God, that's great," I said. "That means Lyle could have gotten into the Fife's house any time he wanted to. Libby's, too."
"It looks that way. He worked for Fears for 8 months, and he sure picked up enough information to give it a try, judging from what Fears said.
unless they had burglar alarms or something like that.
Listen, the only security system they had in effect was a big German shepherd that got hit by a car 6 weeks before Lawrence Fife died. He and his wife and kids were away when the dog was killed.
Nice, Gary said. Nothing you could prove after all this time.
But it might put you on the right track at any rate.
What about the application? You want a copy?
I'd love it. What about Fife's accounts?
I've got those at my place, and I'll look at them when I can.
It's a lot of stuff. In the meantime, I just thought you might want to know about that locksmith stint.
I appreciate your help. Jesus, what a schmuck that guy is.
I'll say. Hey, I got another call coming in. I'll be in touch.
He gave me his home phone in case I needed him.
You're terrific. Thanks.
The second message was from Gwen at Canine Corners. One of her assistants answered, and I listened to assorted dogs bark and whine while Gwen came to the phone.
Kinsey?
Yeah, it's me. I got your call. What's happening?
Are you free for lunch?
Just a minute. I'll check my appointment book, I said. I put my palm against the mouth of the receiver and looked at my watch. It was 1:45. Had I eaten lunch? Had I even eaten breakfast today?
Yes, I'm free.
Good. I'll meet you at the Palm Garden in 15 minutes if that's okay for you.
Sure, fine. See you shortly.
My glass of white wine had just arrived when I glanced up to see Gwen approaching from across the courtyard. Tall and lean, her gray hair slicked away from her face. The blouse she wore was a gray silk, long full sleeves nipped in at the wrist, the dark gray skirt emphasizing her trim waist and hips. She was stylish, confident, like Nikki in that, and I could see where both women must have appealed to Lawrence Fife. I guessed that once upon a time Charlotte Mercer fit the same mold, a woman of stature, a woman of taste. I wondered idly if Libby Glass would have aged as well had she lived. She must have been much less secure at 24, but bright, someone whose freshness and ambition might have appealed to Lawrence as he neared the age of 40. God save us all from the consequences of male menopause, I thought.
Hello, how are you? Gwen said briskly, sitting down. She removed the napkin beside her plate and ordered wine as the waitress passed.
Close up, her image softened, the angularity of her cheekbones offset by the large brown eyes, the purposeful mouth tinted with soft pink. Most of all, there was her manner, amused, intelligent, feminine, refined.
How are all the dogs? I said. She laughed.
Filthy. Thank God. We're swamped today, but I wanted to talk to you. You've been out of town.
I just got back Saturday. Have you been trying to get in touch?
She nodded.
I called the office on Tuesday, I think. Your answering service said you were in Los Angeles, so I tried to reach you there. Some total nitwit answered.
Arlette.
Well, whoever it was, she got my name wrong twice, so I hung up.
The waitress arrived with Gwen's wine.
Have you ordered yet?
I shook my head. I was waiting for you.
The waitress got out her order card, glancing at me.
I'll have the chef's salad, I said.
Make that too.
Dressing?
Blue cheese, I said.
I'll have oil and vinegar, Gwen said, and then handed both menus to the waitress who moved away. Gwen turned her attention to me.
I've decided I should level with you.
About what?
My old lover, she said. Her cheeks had flushed mildly. I realized that if I didn't tell you who he was, you'd be off on some wild goose chase, wasting a lot of time trying to find out his name. It really amounts to more mystery than it's worth.
How so?
He died a few months ago of a heart attack, she said, her manner turning brisk again. After I talked to you, I tried tracking him down myself. His name was David Ray. He was a schoolteacher. Greg's, as a matter of fact, which is how we met. I thought he should know that you were asking questions about Lawrence's death, or at any rate that your curiosity might lead you to him.
How'd you find him?
I'd heard that he and his wife had moved to San Francisco. Apparently he was living in the Bay Area, where he was a principal of one of the Oakland public schools.
Why not tell me before?
She shrugged. Misplaced loyalty, protectiveness. That was a very important relationship, and I didn't want him involved at this late date.
She looked at me, and she must have read the skepticism in my face. The flush in her cheeks deepened almost imperceptibly.
I know how it looks, she said.
First I refused to give you his name, and then he's dead and out of reach. But that's exactly the point. If he were still alive, I don't know that I'd be telling you this. I thought that was probably true, but there was something else going on, and I wasn't sure what it was. The waitress arrived with our salads, and there was a merciful few minutes in which we busied ourselves with Melba rounds. Gwen was rearranging her lettuce, but she wasn't eating much. I was curious to hear what else she had to say, too hungry to worry about it much until I'd eaten some.
"Did you know he had heart trouble?" I asked finally.
I had no idea, but I gather he was ill for years.
"Did he break off the relationship, or did you?"
Gwen smiled bitterly. "Lawrence did that, but I wonder now if David might have engineered it to some extent. The whole affair must have complicated his life unbearably."
"He'd told his wife."
"I think so. She was very gracious on the phone. I told her that Greg had asked me to get in touch, and she played right along. When she told me that David had died, I didn't even know what to say to her, but of course I had to babble right on. How sorry, how sad. Like some disinterested bystander making the right noises somehow. It was awful. Terrible."
"She didn't mention your relationship herself?"
"Oh, no, she was much too cool for that. But she did know exactly who I was. Anyway, I'm sorry I didn't tell you to begin with."
"No harm done," I said.
"How's it going otherwise?" she asked. I felt myself hesitate.
"Bits and pieces. Nothing concrete."
"Do you really expect to turn up anything after all this time?"
I smiled. "You never know. People get careless when they're feeling safe."
"I guess that's true."
We talked briefly about Greg and Diane and my visits with them, which I edited heavily. At 2:50, Gwen glanced at her watch.
"I've got to get back," she said, fishing in her purse for her billfold. She took out a $5 bill.
"Will you keep in touch?"
"Sure," I said. I took a sip of wine, watching her get up.
"When did you last see Colin?"
She focused abruptly on my face.
"Colin?"
"I just met him Saturday," I said, as though that explained it. "I thought maybe Diane might like to know he's back. She's fond of him."
"Yes, she is," Gwen said.
"I don't know when I saw him last myself. Diane's graduation, I guess. Her junior high school graduation. What makes you ask?"